Continuing in Mitzvah Resh Mem Ches 248, not to eat and drink as a glutton in a manner that could turn you into a ben sorer or moris. So Rabbi Dinei HaMitzvah, what are the halachos, the rules governing this type of eating? Masha Amr Zichron Levracha, so the Chachamim tell us, She'ein ben sorer or moris chayav. So we have a lot of qualifications to become a ben sorer or moris because we would like to minimize the amount of the number of times that someone could become a ben sarmar. We want to eliminate every, as part of the system, though, we want to eliminate every possibility. Ad sheyignov mishel aviv, so this boy has to steal from his father, v'yikne basar v'yayin bezol, and he has to purchase meat and wine cheaply. And it's very strange because usually you have strict rules as to exactly what is considered the parameters of the mitzvah. But here it just says cheaply. So I guess the Beis Din has to figure out whether they consider the price that they paid for this wine and this meat to be cheap or not.
Who cares if it's cheap? I don't understand.
Because if it's too expensive, he's not going to be able to maintain his habit. The whole point is that since this eating right now is going to give some indication as to how this fellow is going to behave when he gets older. So if he constantly is buying the cheapest way that he only the meat that's on sale, so that's a habit he could keep up. But if he buys prime rib and eats it, so he's not going to be able to buy that every day when he grows up.
Yeah.
And the wine also, everything has to be cheap. V'yochalos on chutz mirishus aviv, you have to eat it outside of one's father's domain. You have to go somewhere else. Bachabura shekulam reikonim ufchusim, that they all have to be worthless, empty people. Again, which is subject to the determination of the Beis Din, because there's no exact qualification as to what's a worthless and empty person.
No, wait, you don't just have to do it in the company of worthless, empty people?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
But every single one, because if there's one righteous person there, so he's going to tell this Ben Zoramora, no, where'd you get the money to buy that?
Uh-huh.
Stole it from your father? You chutzaf, he's going to slap him and talk some sense into him, and he's not going to go down that path when he gets older. That you have to eat the meat medium rare. No, nowadays that's considered to be the most delicious way to eat meat. But in the olden days, having it not completely raw, but not completely cooked either. So that was the way that thieves ate their meat, because they had right, like Michael Ben Drusai, that it's only a half or a third cooked. Be that, in other words, they had to cook very quickly. They didn't have time to wait till the meat was nice, well done, thoroughly brown all the way through, which is obviously the most ideal way to eat the meat. Obviously, we don't consider it that way nowadays, but they did in the olden days. They wasn't fully cooked if it was medium rare. So if you have the meat medium rare, that was a sign that you were in a real hurry to eat and you couldn't wait any longer. So that.
Sorry, what does this phrase actually mean? Chai v'eino chai.
Raw and not raw.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
No.
I mean,
right, it means in between raw and cooked.
Okay.
Yeah.
It just seems like an odd.
It's a funny turn of phrase that you have in rabbinical literature, like air ve'ino air means you're awake and not awake, which means you're sort of drowsy and not fully awake. So it just means in between raw and cooked. V'yishte hayayin mozug ve'ino mozug. And you have to drink the wine in a manner mixed and not mixed. So it means half mixed. So we know that the normal proportions of how to mix wine that were in the times of Chazal were 1/4 wine and 3/4 water. And so with it, what this means is it would be like, half wine, 50-50, half wine and half water, something of that nature. Keder shar geranim shosin. So people who are drunkards, they drink the wine in this manner, that they don't take the pains to make sure it's properly diluted to only 1/4 wine, but they can't drink it full strength either, because that's just unpalatable. They would never be able to continue that habit. So basically, the reason that the Ben Sarmor has to follow this pattern is because if he drank it full strength, then that would not be something he'd be able to keep up throughout his life, because he can't tolerate full strength wine. I mean, in the times of Chazal, it was that tastes were different, eh? First of all, tastes were different, and second of all, the wine was a little more syrupy, so it wasn't as palatable as our contemporary wines. Also, it's interesting to note that it can't be salted meat, and it can't be I mean, not, I'm not talking about salted in terms of the halachic salted, but it can't be overly salted meat, and it can't be also yain migito. It can't be grape juice, which is called in halachic literature fress wine, wine straight out of the press, because that's not something anyone could tolerate for long periods of time.
So it wouldn't get them drunk. I mean, assume, you know,
it's not even necessarily the issue of getting drunk. You don't have to. One of the criterion is not that you have to get drunk. Just the idea that you're being a drunkard, you're drinking in a gluttonous manner. V'hu sheyochal mishkal chamishim dinar mi-basar zeh belugma achas, v'ishtachatzi lug mi-yayin zeh bevas achas. So you have to eat, what is that? I looked that before, but what does it say? 6 ounces or something.
Yeah, 6.6 to 8.5 or something like that, you know.
That's right. So one fell swoop, you have to down that amount of meat. It's a relatively large amount of meat, and you have to drink a half a lug of wine. So what's half a lug? So we know that the standard measurement of wine in halacha is revius halug, a quarter of a lug, which is 75 milliliters, approximately 2.6 ounces. So if you have a chatzi lug, that's, mathematician can tell us, is double a quarter lug, so it's two revios, and that would be 150 milliliters, approximately about 5 ounces. Yeah, that's not so much wine. But the meat seems more excessive than the wine, but in the event, that's what it is. So, Masha Amru, Shim Achal Achila Zohan Mechoeres, Mi Basar Asur. So, if you, the Ben Sar Mora, eats impermissible meat, so you have if it wasn't shechted properly, if it was a trefa, O Biyom She Asur Bachila Vafilo Betainas Derabonan, She'eino chayev. And on a day that it's not permitted to eat, even if it's only Asar B'Tavis, which is coming up, but, you know, a day where the restrictions of eating are very light, are not very stringent. Yom Kippur, obviously, Midoraisa, you're not allowed to eat. Tisha B'Av is very stringent, you're not allowed to eat. But Asar B'Tavis, again, it's very easy. Anybody who's slightly ill doesn't have to fast on Asar B'Tavis. But even so, even if there's some Tainis Derabanan, even though there's some, any type of prohibition of eating, then it doesn't count for the Ben Sarer or More, because it has to be that he's doing it purely out of rebelliousness and just, you know, plugging away at the eating, and not that he's violating also a prohibition of eating per se in halacha on that day. It's also, by the way, it applies that you can't be also an Achila Shel Mitzvah. It can't be that they're eating it at a wedding or at a nichum avelim if you're going to a mourner's house and they're trying to comfort him, or they're eating ma'aser sheni in Yerushalayim, even if they do all these things, so then it's not, it doesn't count. It has to be purely voluntary that they're doing it just to be a ben sarer mor. There can't be any admixture either of independent or other type of avera or of mitzvah. Shneamar einenu shomea bikolenu. That the Torah says that Ben Sarmor is someone who doesn't listen to our voices, meaning the mother and father. Misheino over beozachilo el al kolam. It's only if you're violating their voices. Yatzazesh over bezafal ba afal divrei Torah. That if you violate also halacha based from this eating, not just the will of your parents, then you don't, doesn't count as a Ben Sarmor. Umasha amru shim achal kol maichal velo achal besar behema. So if you could eat 20 pizzas in one sitting and not become a ben sarer mor, you have to eat specifically the flesh of a domesticated animal, which is considered to be the most delicious in halacha. Ein simcha ela b'basar is really talking on the meaning, like shasa kol mashke velo shasa yain poter. Even if you drink an entire bottle of Old Smuggler whiskey, that doesn't count. It has to be specifically wine. V'atam min ha'shorah shekasav nu l'malu. The reason is above. V'yishein ha'tev anim shachach ha'shum devar kol kach kibo ba'elu. That people who like to drink, specifically like wine, people like to eat and generally enjoy specifically meat. Which is, again, I mean, people who are alcoholics, I don't think limit themselves to wine. They like all these things. But again, the issue is not the alcohol per se. It's just something that people are going to indulge in too much. And that's most likely with meat and with wine. It says, by the way, that the whole shear doesn't have to be from Besar Behema. That if you eat mostly, it's a shaila about how much, what the breakdown has to be, but if you eat mostly Besar Behema, and then, but the last bit to complete the shear is with Besar Oaf, is with poultry, then that also is a problem, and you can become a Ben Sarmora from eating that.
So wait, so as soon as mitzvah, you should actually have, you know, the basar behema then, right? You shouldn't have chickens or something like that.
Right, since it says ein simcha ela b'basar, really talking about the basar shlamim, that when it says that on yantif you have to have simchas yantif, really it's talking about eating the meat from the korban that's required you have to bring on yantif, which of course is a basar behema. So as to emulate that, the idea that they have the same type of taste, that they're ein simcha ela b'basar, you have to have a basar behema. That's why ideally at a sudas mitzvah on yantif, also when you have to have simcha. I can't say you, it's absolutely required. Women, it's not required, it's only for men. That women, their simchas yantif is by getting jewelry and new clothes for yantif. So that's the simchas yantif for women, but for the simchas yantif for men is eating meat and drinking wine. Of course, a woman, if she enjoys meat, that's wonderful, that's a kiyum of simchas yantif, but the classical example of simchas yantif in the literature for women is not eating meat, so it's not as required for women as for men.
Things are busted,
oh, we'll get there.
Oh, really?
We'll get there.
All right, I think of everything.
Yeah. Yep, you do. That's absolutely true. But if you don't have besar behemah, the next best thing is besar chai, and then it would be poultry after that. But ideally, again, on a sudas mitzvah at a wedding, you're supposed to have besar behemah. Ideally, some say at a bris, you're supposed to have besar behemah. I wanted to do this when we made the bris, but. didn't work out. I thought people... Yeah, there's a balancing factor, which is that at that time of day. So now in contemporary society, people don't enjoy it as much. So you don't want to do this just to get a kick out of it. You really have to try to please the guests. Rav Schefter has a story that someone once invited him to a wedding, probably a Baal Tshuva or something. I don't know exactly. The family wasn't exactly on board with everything, so he was getting married. So he said that he's having... said something about the menu that he's having, pasta with cheese as the core. I don't know exactly what it was. So Rav Schefter said, it's really more correct at a wedding that to have meat as opposed to have milchiks. So the fellow said, Rebbe, I'm not interested in your psak right now. Please don't tell me this. Just please show up to the wedding and we'll discuss later. Rav Schefter said that he found out later that the reason that he was serving milchiks at the wedding, he really wanted to have fleishiks, but apparently the caterer that was chosen by his family, he didn't trust the kashrus of the fleishiks, so he insisted on having the milchiks. That's why he said to Rav Schefter, we'll discuss it later. I'm not, just don't tell me about that right now. Vinyan Kates Adonino, so how do you judge the Ben Sorum? Or Vechesan Masrimbo, how do you administer the warning? We mentioned briefly last time that's a machlokes between the Rambam and Rashi, how you do the Hasra. That according to the Rambam, it's a regular Hasra. The Ben Soremor is about to engage in his eating with his whole chevre of worthless friends. And his parents say to him in front of the two Edim, don't eat that, don't do this, don't eat in this chevre right now where you're going to become a Ben Sorer More. And then the Ben Sorer More just has to say, no, I want to eat with my friends and I don't care what you're going to do to me, it's fine. And then proceed with the eating. That's according to the Rambam, that's a regular Hasra. But Rashi says it's not a regular Hasra.
What is a Hasra?
The warning, to admonish the person before you can administer the penalty. The Rashi is not a regular Hasra. It's just when the parents get a bad feeling about their son, that they take him in front of two witnesses and say, listen, don't go steal from me and do not go eat with your friends and steal and buy busar v'yayin, buy meat and wine cheaply and then proceed to eat it. Don't do that. It doesn't have to be with all the dinim of a regular hasra, but the Rambam holds it does. V'chesed machrizin alav, how do you announce about the Ben Sorer Mora? So that's after the Ben Sorer Mora is put to death, then you have to write to all the Jewish people and you have to announce that so and so was put to death because he was a Ben Sorer Mora, because it says in the Torah, that the whole Jewish point is to teach a lesson to the Jewish people that we shouldn't have Bonim Sorim Umorim. You shouldn't have these types of people, so people have to find out about it. So this, I guess nowadays you have to post on Facebook that there was a Ben Sorer Mora and give details of that. Part of the intrinsic requirement of a Ben Sorer Mora is that the parents both have to be on board. If the parents want to forgive this violation, then they are allowed to do so and they will not be tried by the Beis Din. The Beis Din is totally subjugated to the desires of the parents in this regard. Shenemar, Besaf Suvo, Aviv Ve'imo, that his parents, his mother and father, have to grab him and bring him to the Beis Din. So if only one of them doesn't want to do it, then that cancels the entire din of Ben Sorer Mora. V'im haya echal mehem gidem, o ilem, o suma, o cheresh, then if either one of them doesn't have an arm or can't speak or is blind or is deaf mute, then Eino Nase Ben Sarah Mora, why Shenemar Vesof Suvo Velo Gidmim. They have to grab him and bring him to the Beis Din, both of them, both parents. So if one of the parents doesn't have arms, then they cannot make him a Ben Sarah Mora. Votziuo, so they have to bring him out to the Beis Din. So if they can't walk, if they're lame, then they obviously disqualifies them. The Amru, and they have to make a statement to the Beis Din that this, our child, is a Ben Sora or Moreh, and please punish him accordingly. So if they can't speak, both of the parents can't speak, then, I mean, either one of the parents can't speak, right? If either one of the parents can't speak, then he can't be a Ben Sora or Moreh. Bneinuze, below Suma, they have to be able to say, this son of ours, so they have to be able to see. If they can't say, this is this son of ours, if they can't see, I mean, they might know it's their son because of Tvias Eina the Kola. What we call a Tvias Ayin means a recognition. So if you recognize the voice, you're not. Tvias Ayin means we're talking about the eye. So obviously, not talking about the eye, but the phrase Tvias Ayin means a recognition, so it means the voice. It's also, you know, if you have to actually see someone, this creates a lot of problems. That it says, like, how can a blind person be with his wife? Because how can he be really sure that it's his wife if he's not he's not seeing her? So the answer is Tvias Eina de Kola, that if he can tell by her voice that it is in fact his wife.
Has there been a Ben Sora?
Oh, we'll get there in a second. Great question. Einenu shomea bikoleinu velo chershin. And they have to, he says, they have to know that he doesn't listen to our voice, and therefore they can't be deaf mutes. Or maybe just deaf in this case, because it just means that they have to hear that he doesn't listen to them. Because of all these details are required in order to make a Ben Sora Moreh. Some of the sages said in the Gemara, there's never been such a thing. There's never been in the entire Jewish history a Ben Sora Moreh. Rabbi Yonasan says, no, I once saw a Ben Sora Moreh being executed and I sat on his grave. The point is not the sitting on the grave. The point is that it was a real, actual, factual occurrence, and he had the ability to sit on the grave of a Ben Sarimur. So there's a disagreement between the Chachamim as to whether this was really carried out or not. Well, if it wasn't really carried out, so what's the point of including it in the Torah? Well, according to the Chinuch A, to teach a lesson about how people are supposed to behave regarding eat and drink, even if you don't actually, you're not actually subject to all the technical details of the mitzvah. And the Gemara also says, if that's the case, that it was never actually happened, so it's drosh v'kabel schar. So God threw in certain things in the Torah in order to give us more material for Torah study and to get more schar, to get more reward for coming up with, for analyzing, rather, all the halachos of the mitzvah in such a manner.
Now, of all the varieties of juvenile delinquency, I mean, yeah. Eating and drinking doesn't seem to be, you know, the worst.
Well, it's stealing, and then eating and drinking in a chevra that's in, you know, getting yourself into a bad crowd and getting into bad habits. Yeah. Masha Amru Kibatchila Malkin also. So the Chachamim tell us you don't go straight to the stoning. First you do lashes. Shenemar V'Yisro also, that they shall chastise him. So that means with lashes. Uvershu Zichron Bracha V'Yisro also Zemalkus. This is referring to lashes. Yeser Protea B'Perek Ches V'Sanhedrin. It's in the 8th Perek of Masechet Sanhedrin, which is appropriately titled Ben Sorer Umore.
What if parents have a son who's been Sora Moreh, but they don't bring him to a Beis Din?
They're allowed, as I said. It's totally in the. It depends on whether they want to bring him to the Beis Din or not. They both mother and father, have to want to bring him. Yeah. And if they're mochel him, even until the Beis Din pronounces the death penalty, the parents can mochel, can forgive the Ben Sora Moreh, and he would not be subject to the death penalty. As soon as the death penalty is pronounced officially by the Beis Din, so then it's too late, and then he would be put to death, even if the parents forgave him afterwards. But no heges be'eretz Yisrael bilvad. This applies in Eretz Yisrael. She'ein donen dinin nefashos ela sham. That the only place where you have capital offenses, and as the Minchas Chinuch has pointed out many times, this is not exactly accurate because it just means that the judges have to have received the ordination in Eretz Yisrael, but it doesn't mean that the trial has to take place in Eretz Yisrael. So if you have 23 judges who have received the official rabbinic ordination in Eretz Yisrael, and then for some reason they all moved to New York, and then you could have a Ben Sora Moreh in New York. There's no reason per se not. Or a Beis Din shall esrim mushlosha lechol apachos. And it has to be a Beis Din of 23 for the second time. For the first time, where it just gets Malchus, so a Beis Din of 3 is sufficient. But where for the death penalty, so you need a Beis Din of 23. Vein din zen noeg, ela bizcharim. Oh, to answer your question, there's no such thing as a bas sorer amore. There's only such thing as a ben sorer amore. Well, lo ben ikevos, it does not apply to girls. She'ein darkon lihimoshech ba'achila ushtia kemo anashim, that females do not have a tendency to indulge too much and eat and drink, and food and drink, as do males, which is interesting. Bezel shenemar, they're more, you know, refined. They wouldn't be sucked into this type of behavior. Bezel shenemar ben soremor velo bas. It's specifically ben soremor velo tumtum vandroginus. It also cannot be someone of questionable gender. So a tumtum is someone who has a membrane covering the genitalia. You can't tell whether this person is a male or a female. And androgynous is somebody who has both male and female genitalia. Ba'filu tumtum shenikra v'nimsa zochar enu nasa ben soremor. So occasionally this membrane that covers the genitalia of a tumtum and you're not sure what gender he is, so sometimes it can rip. Either you can rip it on purpose or it could somehow, I don't know, just as the person gets older can rip on its own. Then you could see for sure whether the person is a male or female. So even if it was discovered that this person was in fact a male, shenemar ki yelo ish ben sorer, ad sheye ben misha savaya. So it says one, the pasuk says, when it shall be unto a man a wayward and rebellious son. So what does it mean when it shall be unto a man? So from the time that the person became unto the father, it shall be a ben. It shall be for certain recognized as a male, as a son. So therefore, even if the person was born as a tumtum, but then later was discovered to be an actual, to be a male, even if that discovery was made before the age of 13, so the person is ineligible forever to become a ben sormor, has to be immediately recognizable as a male at the time of birth. The overall zev and asa ben soremor al pi kol hadvarm shekasavnu niskal. So if all these things happen to you and you fulfill all the criteria, then you receive the penalty of stoning. Varehu kechol haruge bezdin shemamonam liyorshehem. So in general, when somebody is executed by the rabbinic court, so they're the normal rules of Yerusha of inheritance apply, and the closest relatives would inherit the property. So here, in this case, you might say, wait a minute. Why should the closest relatives inherit the property of a ben soremor? Who is the closest relative of a child? The parents. Until you have a child of your own, so your parents are the closest relatives. So it's the shtickle chote niskar. So we brought the child to become a ben soremor. We get all the possessions? No, but the din is that. The avopi sha'aviv garam lo skila reo yorish kol nechasav. Even though it was the father who caused the child to be put to death, he still inherits all of the possessions of the ben soremora. So presumably it's something that the Bezdin has to check into. If ben soremora has made some good investments and is independently wealthy, so we have to make sure that the father is not falsely accusing the child of being a ben soremora. They're maybe hiring witnesses to testify that this person did all the requirements of ben soremora, so the father could inherit all the possessions of the ben soremor. But in a normal case where the bezdin can confirm that didn't happen, and the person it was in fact a legitimate case of ben soremor, then the father still inherits all the money.
Is there an age limit on a ben soremor?
13 and 3 months.
Oh. Yeah.
Well, not exactly. It's 3 months after physical maturity. 3 months after, whichever comes first.
Okay, so that comes, that's the beginning, or that's the end?
The first time someone could become ben soremor is when two pubic hairs develop after the age of 13. And the end time of ben soremor, according to understanding of Moshitis, is that it's either 3 months after that, or until the pubic hair has created an arc around the member, is whichever comes first is the end of the time where a person could become a ben soremora. So you have a maximum period of 3 months.
Now, I think you talked about this last time, but why is the discussion of ben soremora here rather than in Dvarim?
Because in Dvarim it just discusses the punishment. Here is, according to Chazal, this is where the Azhara, where it actually says you're not allowed to do it, yeah. Fine. Mitzvah Reish Mem Tes 249. Shalonachesh is a title. Not to, in modern Hebrew, lenachesh means to guess. Very, not offensive term. A very harmless phraseology, but in the Torah it means something worse. Shelo neilech acharei nechoshim, that we shouldn't go in accordance with divination. Is that what title does the Art Scroll say? How does he translate?
Superstitious omens.
Yeah. Okay, well, that not to follow superstitious omens. Shenema lo senachashu. It says again in a different place in the Torah, Shenemar, lo yimotzei v'cha u'menachei. So in Dvarim, where it repeats a lot of prohibitions that are previously in the Torah, it says, it shall not be found amongst you someone who's menachei. Again, we don't have a good English translation word for word, but superstitious omen is a good approximation. V'amr b'sifri, the Halachic Medrash says, Menachesh kigona omer nafla piti mipi. I was eating, and all of a sudden my bread fell out of my mouth. Nafla makli miyadi, I was walking along and my cane fell. Avar nachash mimini v'shual mismoli, that a snake passed by my right, or a jackal or a fox by my left. V'imna mnekein ma'asoshu maisa. So he says that's a bad omen, and therefore I'm just going to stay home today and I'm not going to go out to work because these things happened to me. Or, in contemporary thought, the black cat crosses your path. Black cat crosses your path. Something that happens to you frequently, probably. Yeah. If a black cat crosses your path, then that's a bad omen. You're going to change your life in a way that shows that you really took into account the fact that this happened. It's a bad omen, and you're going to refrain from doing something you would have otherwise done. Uvesifra, the halachic medrash over here. Before he was quoting the halachic medrash on Dvarim. But here it says, "Amr lo senachashu kigon elu amenachashim bechulda uveofos uvekochavim bechayotzeben." That if you look for omens with a weasel, if a weasel does something, I don't know exactly what it would do, but if it does this, then you're going to change your behavior and you're going to do something else. Or for birds, or for you look in the stars, astrologer, and if the stars are aligned in a certain way, then you're going to change your behavior accordingly. Ein mazel Yisrael, that Jews are not subject to the stars, the omens of the stars. You know?
Well, I mean, isn't there a notion like, you know, you shouldn't, if you have a court case in, you know, the month of Av, it's not a propitious time to,
That's
the month of Adar.
I mean, that's in the Gemara, right. That's in the Gemara, because you see from Jewish history that this is an auspicious time, yeah.
That's sort of superstition. I mean, that.
Superstition means that it's something random of your own accord.
Yeah, I agree. I feel as if it's filled.
I'll have to look at Jewish encyclopedia under S or something to see what's
right. Superstition means it's of your own accord that it's not rational and you just decided that this was. But if it's part and parcel of Jewish tradition per se, that this month you see in the past that good things happened in this month all the time and that bad things happened in the month of Av repeatedly. So therefore, you conduct yourself accordingly. You try to avoid court cases at the time.
When during the month you get married, I'm trying to think what it is.
Right. The Rama brings that in Shulchan Aruch where it talks about in this part where it talks about the nechoshim, the superstitions, talks about how that's not a problem. Again, he doesn't explain himself. He just said that's not an issue to specifically get married in the middle of the month when it's the full moon and it's considered to be a more auspicious time. You're right. The exact delineation between where it's okay and where it's not okay is not always clear. You're right.
As the people wear.
The Rath raises in the Tosefta in Masechet Shabbos. Okay. It says that if you tie a red string around yourself, it's Darkei Amori. It's the way of the Amorites. It's not allowed. Asher. Yeah, the red string is also a problem. Mm-hmm. Maybe if you see a red string on someone, it might be mutter to rip it off and throw it in the garbage. And I'm not saying I advise doing that, but according to technical halacha, it could very well be.
It's a...
Oh!
Yeah, right.
Do it in private. No, embarrassment, if something it has to do with a mitzvah, then it doesn't apply. Like I said, if you somebody, again, in a situation, we were talking about with the mitzvah of tochacha, of rebuking people, so if people are doing an avera, so in order, if you think that you'll be successful in getting them to stop in this manner, you are allowed to rebuke them publicly and publicize their transgression in order to get them to behave properly. That doesn't apply to b'makom mitzvah. Same thing, if you see somebody who's wearing shatnez d'oraisa in the street, so you go over to them and you're allowed to rip their clothes off. Because it's Shana's Daraisa. You could look. Maybe you have a good eye for the fabrics. If you know for sure it's Shana's Daraisa, you're allowed to live. If it's Shana's Darabanan, then you go tell them, and they're allowed to go into a building, a private area, before they take off their clothes. But if Shana's Daraisa, they have to take it off immediately. Can't even go 1 second. Even if it means you're going to be walking around the marketplace in your underwear. You're not allowed, and you have to take it off. Okay, but that's not that for a mitzvah. It doesn't, the embarrassing thing doesn't apply. Again, if you, that will actually successfully change the behavior, and the same thing. So over here, okay, you're not allowed to do these things. A lot of things that Jews do nowadays, they consider to be schoolas, are really usur.
Gives some examples. He gives.
Yeah, he gives more examples. Ha'amim ascholim, though it's stupid people just say. Kevan sheshavti midarki shayisi holech, o tzvi hifsiko. So since I came back from what I was walking, I don't know exactly what that means, but I was walking in the way, and a deer, tzvi doesn't really mean deer, but yeah. Colloquially it means deer, it really means gazelle, so they walked in front of me and stopped me from walking. So since that happened, o rev tzoek over aroshi, or there was a raven that was flying above me and was shrieking. So all these things were bad omens. Okay, van shirisi dover ploni betchilas yom lo arviach hayom. Or if I was, you know, walked out of my house in the morning and the first thing I saw was a snail. I don't know, whatever in your mind is a bad omen. Mm-hmm. So you say, oh, I'm not going to make any money today anyway, so I'm not going to bother going to work, and I'm just going to go home and watch TV all day. Osho mikra ra yivoy, or maybe you're afraid of continuing because since the first thing you saw today was a snail, that you're going to be, if you continue any farther, you're going to be run over by a car next. So all these types of things are included in this negative commandment. Mishor sheha mitzvah lefishe inyanim eila hem divrei shigon v'sichlos gimura. These things are craziness and stupidity. Ulam kadosh amiti asher bachar hakeo lo yeus lahem sheyishu b'divrei sheker. For the holy nation that God chose, it's not appropriate, it's not befitting that they should be dwelling on these false things. That if you focus on these things, you're not going to be focused enough on God. And from this, you're going to get into full denial of God. You have to realize that the real way that the world works is that if you follow what God says, then you get blessing and you get good things happen to you. If not in this world, then in the Olam Haba. And that you're going to think that it's just random, that everything is random, and it goes, all these superstitious things really have power over you, and it's not God who has power over you, and it's not God's focus on you and supervision of you that's really what's running the world. But you're going to lose track of all the fundamentals of religion if you think this way. Since God wanted our benefit, you have to take all superstitions out of your head, and you have to establish in your heart that anything good and bad that happens to people is from God's mouth, and not due to these things that people do. These things are irrelevant. Lo ma'aridim, lo ma'alim, v'lo ma'aridim. They don't benefit. They don't hurt. Uchmoshe kasuv kilo nachash b'Yakov lo kesem b'Yisrael. One of the brachos of that Bilam gave to the Jewish people was there is neither superstition nor magic within the Jewish people, that they rely completely on God. That was in those times. For throughout the long Golos, there have been superstitions, Jewish superstitions that have developed, but really it's not appropriate. You shouldn't think about superstitions at all. Prote ha-mitzvah b'perek shvi mi-shabes u-v-tosefta de-shabes. So all the details of this mitzvah are found in the Gemara in the 7th perek of Masecha Shabbos and in the Tosefta of Shabbos. Why are these found in Maseches Shabbos? Anybody can think of it?
Because let's say if you're going to go out in a Shusa Ravi wearing like a red, you know, like string or something like that, whether that's, you know,
exactly 100%. The Mishnah at the end of the 6th parak of Masechah Shabbos, the 6th parak of Masechah Shabbos, by the way, talks about what you're allowed to wear on Shabbos and what you're not allowed to wear, not just what constitutes Hotzah. what's actually considered carrying. They're things you could be wearing that are actually that you would say in English that you're wearing them that actually in halacha are considered carrying. But there is also a whole gamut of things discussed in that perek that are not technically carrying, but we're concerned that if you wear them outside on Shabbos, you might take them off and then carry them. So one of the things that it discusses in that perek is the halacha of a kamiya, which is an amulet. Mm-hmm. So what types of amulets are you allowed to wear on Shabbos? What types are you not allowed to wear? Maybe not. If it's rationally been proven to work, then it's not nechosh. If it's then it's not a superstition. Again, whether by today's standards it would be proven rationally to work or not is a different story. But in the olden days, when you had amulets, and for whatever reason an amulet appeared to have cured an illness three times, it was considered to be that this amulet was known to cure this illness. So it was rational to assume that this amulet works. Nowadays, it might not be so rational, but... So on Shabbos, you're allowed to go outside wearing a kamiya mumcha, wearing an amulet that's known to work on Shabbos. So then it says at the end of the perek, it's a discussion as to whether you're allowed to wear like the tooth of a jackal or certain superstitious things that were considered to have an effect that could heal you. And so I think Reb Meir, if I'm not mistaken, says that you're allowed to wear these things outside on Shabbos. And the Chachamim say, forget Shabbos, you're not allowed to wear them on weekdays. Because it's an issue of Darkei Amori. So then, and that's it in the Mishnah. But then the Tosefta has two whole prakim dedicated to expounding on this idea that was stated briefly in the Mishnah, which is what's considered Darkei Amori. All these things, are not strictly separated in Chazal. What's Darkei Amori? What's Nichush? What's Meonen? Is another thing that's going to come up. It's all under the umbrella category of superstitious, things that smack of Avodah Zarah. So what things you're allowed to wear on Shabbos, what things you're allowed to do or not, whether it be Shabbos or whether it's weekdays. Benoheges, b'chol makom v'chol zman, all places and all times, v'zachar and akevos, males and females. V'over aleh, v'osa shum maisa al pi anachash, be'edem v'asra aloke. If you changed your behavior based on the superstition and you had witnesses and warning, then you receive the penalty of lashes. V'davka v'bezdin shel esrim v'shlosha, obviously it's to be in a bezdin of 23, v'chein b'kol mokom shekosavnu b'ma shekodam. Any of these examples that we gave before. B'ma shenichtov loke ha'kavona hi be'eretz ha'kedosha. It means in Eretz Yisrael, at least with Dayanim who received the ordination in Eretz Yisrael, shimokom ha'mishpat shel esrim v'shlosha. That's when normally that's where that's where the courts of 23 people met, because that's where they received the ordination, that's where the Jews mostly lived. Shein don adin nefashos b'chutz la'aretz ela b'mosor Bilvad, that you can't kill someone in a sort of judicial manner only in chutz laretz, only a musar. Remember what a musar is? We discussed that previously. That's somebody who masers. That's the English terminology. Who informs on the correct English word is masar, but if you want to say inform, that's okay too. That inform. If you inform on the Jewish people to the non-Jewish authorities, so that's a musar, and that type of person, you're allowed to kill in chutz laretz, even without it. But that's extrajudicial. That's not that you go to court and you have the bezdin of shloshim esrim v'shlosha decides that this person is to be killed. No, it's just something that the community has to realize on its own. But again, the Sefer Chinuch does mention that you could, in theory, have a court of 23 people who were ordained in Eretz Yisrael, outside Eretz Yisrael also. L'vishim yisaso hatzola v'tichya alachirim tovim mimenu. Utachaya, I'm sorry. So it could cause other people to stay alive. So you have to kill one person in order to help the rest of the Jewish people maintain peace and well-being within themselves. The Gemara in Maseches Chulin in Perek Gid Anosha, which is quoted by the Mefarshim here on the Sefer Chinuch, has a very interesting line that's been hotly debated. It says, any nachash, any superstitious omen that's not like the superstitious omen of Eliezer Eved Avram, mm-hmm. and Yonasan Ben Shol is not considered a Nachash. So what does that mean? Oh, so first of all, let's just review. What did Eliezer, the servant of Avram, say?
If I meet somebody, does this with a well, and so on and so on.
Right, and offers me to drink and says, I'm going to also give your camels to drink, then that is the girl that you have designated for Yitzchak. That's what Eliezer said.
That indicates a certain character trait.
So a lot of Mefarshim say, like Mrs. Hirsch. It's true, since that was rational, so that's not a problem.
Okay.
So it says, since she's demonstrating excellent character traits, so that's one answer. And what did Yonasan ben Shaul do? There was one time when Yonasan, the son of Shaul, was about to attack a garrison of Plishtim, and he said to his servant, if they say, stay right there, if we approach them and they say, stay right there, then we're not going to attack. And if they approach them, if we approach them and they say, oh, we're going to come up to greet you, then we are going to attack them. So the so it's not clear what the Gemara means. Does the Gemara mean that these were examples of forbidden Nachash? How could it be? These great tzaddikim, Eliezer, Avraham, Yonas, and Mishal, they violated this prohibition of Nachashim. That's what the Rambam sounds like. In Hilchos Avodah Zarah, he doesn't mention Yonas in there. The question why that's the case, maybe he didn't have a girsa, maybe other reasons, but he mentions Eliezer Eved Avram. So he says, so any Nachash is not like Eliezer Eved Avram, is not a Nachash, and you wouldn't technically violate the prohibition. So the Ravid over there really has an, you know, he's normally very harsh to the Rambam, but he really gets very upset over here. He says, how could you say that such huge tzaddikim, Eliezer, Eved Avram, he sinned and he did the sin of Nachash? Said, if he were alive now, he would shoot out rays of light into your face and kill you, presumably. That you said something like this about him.
Well,
he was the Avram's favorite servant.
So that was it, yeah.
So he had to be a tzaddik, otherwise he wouldn't hire him.
Yeah. He was in charge of Avram's whole house. Yeah. Avram was a kulo chesed.
But do you think Avram would go ahead and then tell somebody in Russia to go and pick out a wife for my son?
Russia,
I mean, that's
not... Yeah.
No.
No, I mean, he trusted him with such an incredibly important job that...
Anyway, so some people say that it doesn't mean that they violated it. It just means that it has to be an omen that you really change your behavior and you do something based on this omen that you receive. But in those situations, it wasn't a problem, A, because it was directly connected to, you know, asking, davening to God to help you with a certain thing, or because it was more rational, that it showed the plishtim, if they said, oh, we're going to come up to greet you, maybe that was an aggression, or again, because of that, it demonstrated good character traits on the part of Rivka, and therefore it was rational to rely on those simanim. Tosfos over there has a different explanation. He says, the Gemara just means it as a sort of a melitza, that it doesn't mean that they violated it. It just means that if you really rely on these omens like these people did, then that's the violation of what's considered a nachash. But how did Tosfos say that they themselves got out of it? What they did was actually not an act of forbidden act of nachash. That he says for Eliezer Eved Avram, they say ein muktam u'me'ucher b'Torah, that the chronology of the episode over there is not exact. That when it says that he put on the bracelets and, you know, chose her immediately after she gave the camels to drink, doesn't mean that. It means really first he asked her, you know, whose daughter she was and where her family was, and when he realized that she was from Avram's family, then he put on the jewelry, even though in the Torah, the way it tells the story is in the reverse order. That's the way they get out of Eliezer. And the way they get out of Yonasan is that he didn't really mean it, that he was going to attack either way. He just knew that this is what his servant needed to hear in order to help him with the attack. He needed to, he was nervous, and he needed to do something out of the ordinary in order to encourage the servant. So whatever it is, how exactly you explain these things, there are many different approaches. The Radak, if you look in the Radak on, usually he just explains the basic pshat and the grammar. But the Radak in Shmuel over there in the story of Yonasan, he has a whole explanation about why this was not a problem of Nachash, which is a little out of character, but it's still very interesting. Again, different approaches, but to summarize, we should not change our behavior based on superstitious omens. It's a violation of the Torah, despite the fact that sometimes we've seen people behave to the contrary.